hearing Tuesday, February 18th, 8 a.m., room 407A, Senate Bill 1, Articles 15 and 16. W. Brown.
Here.
Carson. Anthony Cook. Anthony Bailey. Steve Roberts. Anthony Smith. Anthony Adam Fairness. Here. Ryan.
I will start immediately into the sections of Article 15. This is the article on the powers of state and local authorities, section 157 is the first one in this article. It is an amendment of the existing section 483.040 and simply amends that section to substitute the term Transportation Commission for the term formerly used of the department. This is the section which gives the authority of the Transportation Commission to designate and classify interstate and intrastate highways within this state and provide a system of marking. This is the section which does take the exception for railroad, highway, freight stations to the authority of the Transportation Commission in determining traffic control signals to be used at these crossings. And that authority is vested in the Public Utility Commissioner. Moving on to section 158, this authorizes the Transportation Commission to adopt a manual and specifications of uniform standards for traffic control devices consistent with the chapter provisions for use on highways. Section 159 states the authority for the local authorities in the traffic control device placement and maintenance. And under subsection 1, subject to the authority pertaining to the railroad highway grade crossing, which I just referred to, of section 157, and subject to the authority vested in the Transportation Commission, the local authority is authorized to place and maintain traffic control devices on highways, not including state highways, which are under their respective jurisdictions. Local authority, of course, has been defined in section 2, along with the other definitions for the motor vehicle code. All the traffic control devices are to conform to the state manual and specifications, whether or not they are placed and maintained by the local authority under subsection 1. Under subsection 2, the Transportation Commission has the general supervision with respect to the placing and constructing by the local authority of these devices so as to achieve uniformity. This is a restatement of existing law whereby the state authority, Transportation Commission, has this right of general supervision in accordance with their right of setting the standards and requiring conformity. Subsection 3 is new provision, the official traffic control devices. The whole section, of course, is new, but some of them are restating in new language existing rules. Subsection 3, however, is an addition. The official traffic control devices, which are placed after the effective date of the Act, are to conform to specs. This, of course, is the grandfather clause allowing those which are in existence at the time of the new specification or at the time of the effective date of the Act to remain sub 4 new specs and location criteria approved after the date of the on which the Act becomes effective do not apply to those in place, but after a reasonable period from this effective date, those which are in place and do not comply with the manual and specs shall be altered so that they do, so that they are in compliance with these standards. sub 5, again, a new rule. When a city determines that a traffic control device is needed on a city street or highway, and of course those terms are synonymous, which has been selected as the route of a state highway, then the city shall submit its written findings and its recommendations in favor of placing this device to the highway administrator. The highway administrator, if he approves the findings of the local authority or the city, he shall notify the city in writing and proceed to construct this device in accordance with the recommendations. If he doesn't notify the local authority, this shall be considered a disapproval. If he does not notify within 90 days after receiving the findings, this shall be tantamount to disapproval of the recommendations. Section 160 relates to the regulation of pedestrian traffic by local authorities. This is similar to existing rules in subsections 4 and 6 of 483-210. Gives the authority to the local authority to establish crosswalks and designate them, that's marked crosswalks of course, and to close marked or unmarked crosswalks and prohibit pedestrians from crossing where a crosswalk has been closed. And the right to prohibit under subsection 3 pedestrians from crossing a highway any place other than within crosswalks, whether marked or unmarked. Section 161, this is the one place where the regulation of speed by the usual pattern of either the State Speed Control Board for highways which are not state highways or the State Transportation Commission for State Highways, this usual pattern is accepted to by the provisions of Section 161 in that this section allows local authorities to regulate speed in public parks which are under their jurisdiction and further provides that notice of any special speed regulation be given by placing signs. This is a rule which we already have in 483-042, subsection 3. Section 162 is an authorization for the use, for regulating the use of freeways, and the several sections following set up the same pattern of authorizing the Transportation Commission on state highways under its jurisdiction and local authorities on highways under their jurisdiction to regulate traffic in certain ways. In 162, it is limited to freeways under their respective jurisdictions, and the provisions are that traffic which would be parades or traffic which would be persons riding bicycles, power-driven cycles, or motor bicycles or other non-motorized traffic could be regulated. And under subsection 2 of 162, such regulation is effective when notice is given by the appropriate signs on the freeways and the approaches to the freeways. Section 163 is the authority for designating through highways and stop intersections. And again, the Transportation Commission with reference to the state highway and the local authorities with reference to the highways under their jurisdiction are authorized to designate through highways by notifying drivers with the appropriate traffic control devices and to designate intersections as stop intersections. Section 164, this is, I point out when we have something which is new, there is presently no authority to designate a no passing zone. Section 164 would allow such designation by highway or local authority in regard to the respective highways under their respective jurisdiction. 165, Transportation Commission again with their authorities under its jurisdiction and the local authorities with respect to those under theirs may designate highways as one way, may designate safety zones, and may, where the conditions warrant, prohibit right or left turns at intersections or prohibit U-turns by all vehicles or certain vehicles, and may require by placing traffic control devices a different course at intersections than that specified in a section 61, which relates to the general rules in that area. Subsection 2 provides that the local authority shall not designate any highway within its incorporated limits as one way without first obtaining the written consent of the Transportation Commission or the county, if the highway is under the jurisdiction of either the commission or of the county. Section 166 is the authority of the cities and counties to control parking on the city, county, and state highways. Cities have the exclusive authority to regulate parking on city streets, and we have included, along with parking, the new term stopping and standing. This is in addition to existing law and covers, of course, the brief stopping for unloading of passengers or for unloading of freight, personal property of one sort or another. So the city, subject to subsection 3, has the exclusive authority to regulate all three of these movements, or lack of, on city streets or highways, including the city streets which have been designated as the route of the state highway under this provision of 373.010, and subject to the provisions before 83.346, which are contained in the following section, on a state highway which is in the city limits of a city. Under sub 2, and this is new, there is no such statement. I think it's been implied that there is no such provision in existing law. Sub 2, counties have exclusive authority to regulate this stopping, standing, and parking on county highways. Subsection 3 relates to the angle parking on the highway and the local authorities, and again, county has been included with city, and so that is new extension of present rule. The city and county may permit angle parking on any highway where the parking is under their jurisdiction, including those selected as the route of state highways, and subject to the provisions of the following section, a state highway within the corporate limits of the city, unless the Transportation Commission has determined that the highway is not sufficiently wide to permit angle parking safely. 167 amends 483.346 so that the term Transportation Commission, term Transportation Commission is used instead of department to conform with what the legislature did in the last session, and also to include the stopping and standing along with parking. This is the section which gives the authority to the Transportation Commission to regulate parking, stopping, and standing on the right-of-way of any state highway, which is outside of cities, and on the right-of-way of any state highway within the corporate limits of a city, if the access to that highway or a real property abutting thereon had been restricted or controlled by the commission before this part of the highway was included within the city over which the parking regulation relates. Under subsection 2, and this is new, the commission has exclusive authority for controlling the parking on state highways within the corporate limits of a city, and this, of course, relates to freeways that are going through the city so that the state commission can have the authority to restrict parking on them. Section 168 amends 483.348 and simply inserts the Transportation Commission term for department, and this section provides that the regulations of parking by the commission must be entered into their official records, and also the sign must be posted giving notice of the regulations. under section 169, this amendment 484030, under existing provisions of 484030 and 8.660, a city attorney is not authorized to prosecute for a violation of state law. This amendment would allow a city attorney to do this. Under subsection 3, as it's set out, the attorney shall have authority to prosecute in the name of the state for a state traffic offense. This would therefore change the present way of proceeding whereby the cities are enacting traffic codes, which are in many instances, of course, word for word the same as the state statute on the same subject. This would not any longer be required under section 169.
Any questions on Article 15? Attorney Brown.
Madam Chairman, earlier I raised a question on section 108 about coasting, which is prohibited to those operating a motor vehicle, and I raised a question as to whether or not that would apply to a motorized bicycle that's coasting downhill, having used a motor to get uphill, and apparently that answer is provided at least in part in section 162.1b, which indicates that motor-driven cycles or motor bicycles are considered to be non-motorized traffic, so I gather that would not be included within that coasting provision. At least that's the way I read it. I raised that question and I just pointed out to John on what I think was on all that. I would gather that in section 106, a motor vehicle does not include a motor bicycle.
I could speak to that. Let's see. Moped. There's been considerable, I think, dispute as to what is or isn't or what should be the regulation for these sort of semi-bicycle, semi-motorized bicycle, and it hasn't really been pinned down in any of the laws. Certainly a bicycle is non-motorized. Certainly a motorcycle is a motor vehicle. It comes under that definition. Motorcycle is defined separately, but it is also under the existing definition, which would not be changed.
Is a motorcycle a power-driven cycle under 162.1b?
Power-driven cycle by itself has not been defined.
Right.
Motor vehicle includes a motorcycle. Now, I don't know if that helps you. I don't think it really does. I'm not answering it, but I don't think that the intent was to put a motorcycle into the category of non-motorized vehicles.
We didn't know what to do with bikes with motors, so we didn't hear.
True.
Possibly, in 162.1b then, the word other might be eliminated, because that's the word that would indicate that a power-driven cycle is deemed to be a non-motorized traffic. Eliminate the word other, that would.
That would be grammatically more correct, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Because we really didn't set the categories out. I could raise thought that non-motorized traffic could include pedestrians.
And horses.
Yes.
Any further comments on section 15? Go ahead.
The next article will be.
Madam Chairman, the next article is the one article in the bill where we have considerably more sections than we do in the committee proposed code, and the reason for it, as we mentioned in our comments in the committee report, is that most of these sections, except for a few significant ones, which I'll touch upon, are really just in the nature of conforming amendments, and that they attempt to reconcile the penalties that we propose for other sections of existing statutory law, primarily in chapters 481, 482, and a few additional sections of 483, where we've made no substantive change, but merely have changed the existing criminal penalties to particular classifications, classes of traffic infractions. So, in the interest of keeping the size of our report down, although there are those who may think we did not try too hard, we didn't set these forth. But the first few sections in Article 16, beginning with Section 170, appear in both in your bill and in your committee report in the Red Book, going up through Sections 173. And from there on over to section 274, where we resume a couple of the sections that are in the printed report but not in the bill, or but that are in the bill but with different numbers. Right? First of all, section 170 and 171, we are just making conforming amendments, in as much as under our provisions in Article 14, the district attorney would not appear in traffic infraction cases unless the defendant's attorney appears. Section 8.660 in Section 170 is amended, and I've made a note here that I'll pass on to the committee for what it's worth. It occurred to me after we completed the report that it might be appropriate to contain a reference to Section 169 under the exception from the clause under Section 170.
Is this where the defendant's attorney appears?
Well, Section 8660 provides the district attorney shall attend all terms, and except provided for traffic infractions under Section 139. Yes, that's the one that states when the district attorney would not appear.
Yeah, but where's the one when the defendant's attorney appears in the DNA?
Well, it's in the same section. subsection 2 of Section 139 provides for both, at any trial involving a traffic infraction, only the district attorney shall not appear unless counsel for the defendant appears.
What's the number that section?
Section 139. And we have that cross-referenced in the new language that we have amended in 8660. The only question I would raise, whether it might be appropriate and a little tidier perhaps, to also reference the new subsection 3 of 484.030, which we do in 169, which is an exception with respect to the city attorney. I think what we're intending is clear, but in any event, to avoid any ambiguity there with respect to 8.660, that might be worth considering.
Mm-hmm.
Then 9.320 is also just conforming amendments so that we wouldn't have a possible conflict in ORS 9.320. Now, Section 172 amends ORS 133.080. Which relates to the statutes that control the use of the citation in lieu of custody in the criminal procedure code. And under existing law, the use of those types of citations would not apply to the vehicle code offenses, which use uniform traffic citations. So we have written an exception except for Class A traffic infractions as provided by subsection 9 of 484.150. And that's the new language that we have written in to provide for the use on an optional basis by the arresting officer of the citation in lieu of custody with respect to a Class A infraction. That's to give the district attorney notice that there has been a citation and an opportunity to run a record check on the driving record to determine whether or not you have a prior offender who should be charged with a traffic crime. And this is again just to conform this statute to the new provision. Then Section 173, where we define an offense, again, just to avoid possible misunderstanding, this amends the one of the definitions that's contained in the Oregon Criminal Code, the definition of offense. Although the definition of traffic infraction as we provided is almost identical to that for a violation as it's defined in the Criminal Code. Then from there on, beginning with section 174, these sections merely are amend existing statutes to write in new penalty provisions. You'll know if you go through this, that we have included a penalty subsection to provide Class C infraction or Class D or whatever seemed appropriate to the committee as we went through these sections in the interim committee to attempt to make them as consistent as we possibly could with the rules of the road penalty provision. Then, beginning with with section 274 in your bill, we again pick up the counterpart to section 174 in your bill, and section 274 is merely a transitional section, covers captions and headings. And section 175 in your book and 275 in your bill contain the repealed sections, and then 276 contains the effective date. This appears in section 176 in your report. Now, just a comment or two about the effective date. We discussed it at some length. We've heard especially the recommendations of Motor Vehicles Division with respect to the period of time that they felt would be required in the event the proposed code is enacted for them to, first of all, get the word out to the driving public, prepare new driving manuals, and do all the necessary work in that area, and also to make required changes in their records and their record-keeping provisions and whatnot. And they felt that, assuming that recent sessions of the legislature are somewhat of a guide for a starting point as far as the sine diagram of the legislature, we anticipated this would give about a year for them to prepare. And also there are other considerations here, I think, with respect to education of law enforcement officers and judges and prosecutors, city attorneys, and whatnot. So this is was not arbitrarily decided on, although I know that there have been some requests laid before this committee that they would like an earlier date for an effective date. Now, with respect to going back and picking up in your bill, section 272 adds section 273 and makes it part of ORS chapter 485. This relates to the flashing red lights on school buses, and this would place it in chapter 485 with respect to a prohibition that against the driver of a school bus or transport bus operating a flashing red light except it's authorized by law to stop for purposes of loading or unloading the school children in the case of a school bus or worker under for the transport bus, and makes the Class C traffic infraction.
Don?
Yes, go ahead.
Did we have some indication that the schools were going to install a yellow or an amber light that would be utilized while the bus was stopping rather than stop? If there were 272, you've got this prohibition, except when he is stopping or has stopped.
Yeah, and
he shouldn't be using the red flashing light when he is stopping.
Well, at the time we drafted this,
right,
this thought he should.
I appreciate that.
Yeah,
I
think there we probably would want to amend this if we're going to change the other section in the bill.
Right, but the other one was not changed and it retained the stopping as well as stop. And this section 273 is a restatement of sub 3 of 485.020, and I think the testimony was before the committee by Mr. Spear that it was going to be a while before the yellow lights were going to be taken off.
Well, has the committee now decided we're not going to amend any other section in the bill relating to school bus lights?
I wasn't quite sure on that. Now I understand how things are done.
Now you're on the site.
Then, one last question, Madam Chairman. Section 170, Don, you mentioned something about including within 8.660 a reference to subsection 3 of 169.
It should be 484.030 is what we're talking about.
Are we mixing district attorneys and city attorneys there? And one's discretionary and one's mandatory. In other words, the district attorney shall, but the city attorney has the authority to, but he need not necessarily show up.
Well,
and apples and oranges there?
Well, not exactly. The only thing is, of course, now we've defined district attorney in the bill to include, where appropriate, city attorneys and county council.
Okay, that's my error then.
Now, if we go with that, and if we say we've defined district attorney to mean that, then I think just the reference to section 139 of the act is sufficient. But I've been through similar things so many times with the discussion about the criminal code sections, where you have something you think you've made it as clear as you possibly can, and yet you end up anguishing with lawyers and judges what you really mean. And of course, we say the city attorney shall have authority.
It doesn't mean he must show up.
Well, it says he has authority to commit to prosecute in the name of the state for a state traffic offense. If he doesn't show up, I don't think anybody will, probably. I think maybe Don would probably agree with that, Don Ashmanis, but I don't think it's vital that you put it in there. Maybe my comment on this, which will be in a minute, might be sufficient. I wanted to be clear that we didn't intend any conflict between section 170, as we've amended ORS 8.660, and what we say is under section 169, where we've written in the new sub 3 to 484.030. That was my only concern. That they said, well, what about the, well, anyway.
Do we have any other questions? You can stay around for a while.
Members of the committee. I'm Don Ashmanis, the city attorney of Beaverton, and I gather I represent the League of Oregon Cities today, at least their little ad hoc group. And I think you understand the position the League has taken on these substantially in support of all the proposed revision, and ask that a small group simply go through and look for minor changes or technical amendments or corrections that might assist the committee. We have presented the clerk with a letter dated February 18th, which is proposed amendment to Senate Bill 1 in response to the suggestions made last Thursday by the League representatives. And this had to do with the definition of district attorney and the search and seizure provisions and the implied consent and the various other suggestions were actually made. We did not submit proposed amendatory language other than the proposal itself as to the amendment of the traffic citation and arrest provisions with respect to hot pursuits and the delivery of summons and citations rather than personal delivery and so forth, because that would involve redrafting at least three sections, and we thought perhaps we don't stand prepared to do that, to go to side. Today, you have a a letter dated February 18th dealing with Article 15, powers of state and local authorities. And again, this is primarily of a technical and corrective nature. There is no intent to make any substantive changes in the law, nor to introduce any controversial elements to your discussion. I won't read the statement because I believe it's halfway clear, at least to me.
Martin, have you seen it?
Yes, I have.
Do you have any objections to it?
No, I examined it, and as far as the state and local, no.
Okay.
So with that, as I say, if the statement is clear, I'd be happy to answer questions. And also thank you for, well, I don't know if I should thank you for putting city attorneys in the position of prosecuting state traffic offenses, which, as you know, at least my experience, has been about the fourth session that that was requested such.
I think it was fifth.
Well, fourth in my experience. But I always dislike appearing before this committee because I can't get my whole little argument here.
Any questions
for
this gentleman?
Thank you. Thanks,
Judge.
Jack Spear. Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jack Spear. I'm with the Department of Education. There are two areas of Article 16 that I'd like to speak to this morning, and one of them is concerning Section 245 on page 130 of the bill.
You have a seat.
Yes, there is one that was. There's two of them actually there, but one of them deals with Section 245. That's a warning light section. At the present time, there's not a provision in law which specifically provides for the use of alternately flashing amber lights on a school bus. We originally had where we were going to introduce a separate piece of legislation asking for this provision to be put in motor vehicle law. And when we realized that this was coming up under Senate Bill 1, and to save this introducing of another legislative bill, we would like to ask the committee here for to add the provision in Section 245, the warning lights section, the provision that would allow for the use of alternately flashing amber and alternately flashing red lights on a school or worker transport bus. You have this in front of you or not, but I have just give it to Don.
Don't move, Madam Chair.
This is not a requirement, but a permissive thing that would coincide with the administrative rule, which we're asking the state board to approve the use of flashing amber lights on a school bus.
Mary, any problems?
This did not come before the committee as a proposed amendment, right? By the Department of Education. But it certainly is in line with what your testimony was, that this is something the State Department was going to be coming to when they got the budget in another couple of years.
We're asking,
they would then use the amber light.
We're going to the state board, the State Department of Education, the State Board of Education, this Friday, and asking that it be effective on 9/1/76, but to coincide with the effective date that's proposed in Senate Bill 1, we're asking it to be permissive after 7/1/76 for the four districts at this time are 12-month schools that can use in for summer school operations.
Right, does it make any problem anyplace else?
Not as far as I know. We haven't gone through equipment from front to back, but it sounds like it'd be very reasonable in content of all the things that have come before the committee in this area.
Right, Senator Smith has moved the amendment proposed by the State Department of Education to Section 245, Agenda 1. Any objection? And so on.
Thank you. The other provision, which I think that Don spoke of a minute ago, on Section 273, which deals with the other portion of the school bus stop law that we spoke of when we were dealing with the first half under section 71, I believe that we would like to request that this be amended. The section 273 deals with what the school bus driver shall do in relationship to the use of the flashing red lights. The section 71 dealt with what the motorist shall do when the school bus uses the flashing red lights. We also believe that, in the same as our testimony in section 71, that the is stopping provision should be deleted from this, and this will go along with the installation of the flashing amber lights. And that also along with the uniform code and with our federal standard 17. We would like to add the provision, and possibly a section B, that the use of the flashing red warning lights at intersections or other places where traffic is controlled by traffic control signals or police officers, that this be prohibited. And also to go along with the way we have operated for the last 14 years, that the operation of flashing red warning lights in loading zones where the bus is entirely off of the roadway be prohibited.
Well, you do have brake lights to warn that you're about to stop.
Yes.
Right?
That warns the back, the following traffic.
We didn't, aren't there other sections done where we didn't delete or stop it?
Well, section 71 he mentioned was one we discussed the other day. Subsection 1 of that section. And I think Mr. Spear brought it up. That's my fault.
Mary, the committee retained the stopping as well as the stops, and so if you change this, I think in 273, you're going to be raising some inconsistencies.
This deals with two different things. One of them is the car that's approaching the bus. One of them is the bus itself. We're dealing with, I think the amber lights obviously will take care of both of these problems, and an administrative rule not allowing the use of red lights until the bus is stopped. But in its present form, section 1, or section 71, if it's left in there, would mean that if a bus should flip its lights on, if it's still moving towards the stop to warn traffic, all cars would have to stop immediately before they could go by. What would happen in our under our present regulation, which asks them to activate them approximately 300 feet in advance of the stop, as you can see, the bus would turn its lights on. Possibly there would be a car or a truck in between the point where the bus will finally make its stop and where the students are standing. So the bus threw its lights on, the bus, the oncoming traffic would stop, and the bus would go right on by and stop at the loading stop. Of course, this will, like I say, hopefully be taken care of. We still have a little problem here with worker transport buses, and Benita might be interested in speaking to that.
Any questions about Tim Brown?
Oftentimes, I see school buses stopping that are not entirely off the roadway. They're in a rural or a suburban situation where there, for practical purposes, no shoulder, and they are four square on the pavement. They stop in one half of the unmarked two-lane road. Now, your requirement in your proposed subsection 1C here is that they operate essentially only when entirely off the roadway, and that's not always possible.
Well, no, this would prohibit the use of the lights where the bus is entirely off of the roadway. The way we instruct drivers now, that is in the same form, that we ask them when they're when it's necessary to either stop on the roadway or if they have children crossing the roadway, that they stay on the roadway and use the flashing red lights. If they can pull completely off and they have no children to cross the roadway and to keep traffic moving,
then they don't,
we ask them not to use
them.
But whenever they're on that portion of the roadway, we want them to use those lights to warn traffic, and obviously they're an obstacle in the lane of traffic.
All right, I misread that. Thank you.
Good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
John Wagner.
Good
Engineer, Region 6, United States Forest Service of Portland. As an agency who has jurisdiction over road systems in the state, I think that the vehicle code, as recognized in its broad definition, defined every way used by the public for vehicles, we think this applies to the system of the National Forest just as well. This should include all the road systems under the federal agencies where they are of a proprietary nature. We see no reason why the general rules of the road should be any different for the public, regardless of what jurisdiction they're traveling in this, within this state. Therefore, we think the federal agency should be clearly included in the vehicle code, and especially in an area like this, this article.
Anita, I'm going to call him in a minute.
And we would like to see them included in about the same respect as local authorities, each in their respective jurisdiction. We think this is particularly true, like in section 159 of this article, but also as it is in 160, 160, 3, 4, and 5. In this particular section 159, we think this is especially true because of the official nature of traffic control devices placed by the jurisdictional agency. This stop sign out here in the bushes somewhere should be just as official in all its legal implications as the one down here on Highway 22 or the one right down here on the corner. This is the same public who uses these roads. Possibly one over near Bend, who got there on Deschutes County Road, and who probably traveled State Highway 22 to get over there. We think it should be just as enforceable under either the state code or under federal regulations. Now, we realize...
Just a minute. Don, what is your answer?
What is my answer? Well, I'm not sure I disagree with what he's saying here. What we've done in the bill, I think, I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but I think what he's talking about, he would like to see us do throughout the bill what we did with respect to the application of speed laws under Article 8.
Correct.
And, now, the bill does not apply the other rules that we're proposing to Forest Service roads. My understanding that at least as far as the United States government is concerned and the provisions of the U.S. code that the Forest Service operates under, that's the way that they think the law is anyway, or in effect. The practice may not be that. I think largely from an enforcement or lack of enforcement capability on the part of the state. But by answer, it seems to me that the consideration is here, number one, what is the law now? And number two, whether or not as a matter of law, that the traffic laws of the state do apply now to the Forest Service roads, and the only reason that they're not enforced is because of lack of enforcement capability. Then it's just a matter of continuing that and maybe stating it in a more definitive manner, because it's a little hard to find that in the state code. But the argument that we should apply the speed law of the state to the Forest Service roads and not any of the others, particularly when you're talking about some of the serious traffic offenses, I'm really hard pressed to defend that approach, frankly. I think that if you think that the think the speed statute should apply to Forest Service roads. About the only rationale you can use to support that distinction is, again, I think it's a practical problem of enforcement capability.
Well, as presently under the bill, speed restrictions are enforced on government roads, U.S. government roads, right? Are speed restrictions in a part
of Article 8?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On federal?
Yeah.
Chairman.
Yeah.
Don, this gentleman from Forest Service. Can Forest Service officials stop people on, bravery on forest roads for enforcement purposes of any kind?
Do you mean the rule of the road, like under the vehicle code?
No, I'm talking about police.
Other types.
Other types of police requirements.
I think they can, but it's very difficult.
You mean stop them, or?
Yes, to actually stop them.
Oh.
Now, it's one thing when you're dealing with all the usual federal regulations, like relate to use of the land, like recreation. Don't camp here, don't build a fire there. That's easy. But we have no police force as such, and we don't have that kind of capability and training.
But do you
we have to use regular employees.
I know, but do you have authority to stop people for cutting Christmas trees on the road?
Oh, yeah.
Tree, you stop the car. You cut that tree, and you shouldn't have cut that tree. Yeah, you cut that out.
Can
you do that?
Yes,
sir.
Well, we put under.
Well, then you have a quasi-police.
Well, yes.
The situation.
Yes.
And then you do have the authority to stop anybody on Forest Road.
But the usual applications of the motor vehicle code, the rules of the road, are usually of a different type, like speed. How could we do anything like that? Keep on the right side of the road. How do you really run them down without a police vehicle or this kind of capability? Just very difficult to do.
Well, but if we undertook to police the forest roads, we have to double our police force, wouldn't we?
Maybe. Of course, we would like to see that. But I think we realize that there is certainly an impact on enforcement activity. But we think a lot of this is also in the future and should rightfully be considered there. Isn't the public entitled to the same protection on these systems as they are on any other jurisdictions in this state? We think it's in the future mostly because we know how the enforcement activity is limited by the financing. We recognize that. Patrol activity has to be within this limitation. Usually that is established by the needs, the situation. We don't see, how could there be any comparison with this road out here with maybe two vehicles a day on it, when you put it up against the section of I-5 with 50,000. But on the other hand, we also have a few roads which do have 500, 800, 1,000 vehicles a day. Now, isn't the public entitled to the same protection on these?
Right, Mr. Wagner, we'll consider the amendment. Maybe another point to make.
Principally that, I've pretty well covered that in this enforcement realm. Right now, the state police, the sheriff's department, do get in our jurisdiction occasionally for other reasons. It's kind of tough if they should come up against us where you couldn't even recognize an official traffic control. This is what bothers us. And we have difficulty enforcing the same thing. Generally, we think that this effort will be provided by the counties because most often the National Forest System is generally an extension of the county system. And we have already provided some aid at this under the so-called system. We have provided some aid to the counties for an increased level of enforcement activity. In fact, we have agreements with some 19 counties right now. But this is enforcement under the state law, not federal regulation. We have no authority to pass that on at all. And this is why it becomes so difficult in this realm of traffic regulation. And like I said, we just don't have the police force to go with it. Now, there's one other thing, I'd also like to make a remark as an individual citizen. Is that permissible?
Yeah.
Okay. I personally always thought that this realm of the motor vehicle regulation enforcement and so on did properly belong with the state. But I also see that I think if a void exists, that the federal agencies will probably try to fill that. And I just would hate to see that. I think it has belonged with the state ever since the motor vehicle was around. And I just would hate to see that happen. Thank you.
Thank you. What's in the way? Thank you. Bill Boulay.
I was on for 16 then.
That's fine. We've done that.
I'm Phil Goulet from Route 1, Jervis, Oregon, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau and Marion County Farm Bureau. I'm here mainly to say that we are in agreement with the amendments made in Article 16 as far as agriculture equipment and the other penalty provisions which have been amended in this section. And I have no specific testimony today. Howard Fuji, who testified before the interim committee, could not be here, and I just got this information about 10 minutes ago. So the main thing is, if there's any questions or anything that anybody would like to answer or ask, this is the main reason why I'm here today.
Any questions, Mr. Goulet? Thank you very much for coming. Vanita, we cut you off the other day on Article 14.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Vanita Howard, Motor Vehicles Division, Public Information Officer. In Article 14, there are a couple of sections that give us difficulty, and I think we just simply wanted to call the possible problem to the attention of the committee. I think in Mr. Paulette's testimony the other day, this concerns section 141, 142, and 144. 141 is the trial judge's authority to order suspension of license, permit, or right to apply. Section 142 says that any suspension ordered by the court under section 141 shall run concurrently with any mandatory suspension ordered by the division. And then section 144 retains the present mandatory license suspension, 30 days, 1 year, and 3 years for DUIL and eluding, and adds the dangerous driving in the first or second degree. Our concern is that if the judge is going to be giving a discretionary suspension in 141, which should run concurrently with the suspension that we might be giving mandatorily over in section 144 on the first offense, and the judge may be sending them to a rehabilitation school or something of that nature, we think there could be some real hang-ups in here between the court and the motor vehicles division that could confuse not only the court and the motor vehicles division, but the individual who happens to be found guilty of the offense. there's a couple of approaches that we'd like to suggest to you, and I do one of them with a somewhat fear and trepidation. But it has occurred to us that since one of the intents of the committee was to give the court increasing sentencing flexibility, that perhaps the time may have come when the mandatory 30-day license suspension that is meted out for DUIL should be eliminated as a motor vehicle division suspension and left in the hands of the court. Now, at the present time, the language in 141 simply says the judge may suspend. If the committee really wants that to be a mandatory suspension on the first offense, then you may want to amend the language in 141 to make it a shall. If you want to retain a mandatory first conviction issued by the Motor Vehicles Division for DUIL, then we would like to suggest that that period of suspension be increased to 90 days. 30 days, sometimes the person who is convicted is more of a paper suspension than it is anything else as documents go back and forth between the courts. We do have some other suggestions that if you would decide to eliminate the DMV-imposed mandatory suspension for the first offense, we would like to suggest that you still retain a mandatory suspension for the first conviction of attempting to elude a police officer or the new offenses of dangerous driving in the first or second degree, and that those suspensions should be 90 days rather than 30 days as provided in Senate Bill 1. We would also like to suggest...
Well, why? It's always been your position that DUIL was much more dangerous as far as safety is concerned, or was the most dangerous.
Yes. You mean why retain the 90 days?
Why make that?
I think if we're going to retain a mandatory suspension for DUIL, it should be 90 days. By the same token, if we're going to have a mandatory suspension, and I think we should definitely have, for fleeing and dangerous driving, it too should be 90 days.
I'm not following that in the red book on the...
144.
Section 144.
On the eluding is where?
Eluding is paragraph 2B, and C is dangerous driving, and then the periods of suspension are provided down here in paragraph 3, and
right.
For first conviction, it's 30 days. Let me point out one of the problems. 2 years ago, when this first conviction has always been 90 days until the 1973 legislature, and it was reduced down to 30 days. At the time, it was our thought that it ought to be an absolute 30 days. But with 30 days and an occupational provision, which we still retain in the law, it is really almost a paper kind of thing that is occurring as far as the first suspension for DUIL. They're coming in with their conviction and their recommendation that they be reinstated for occupational purposes, and it's out one door and in another door. Sometimes we have the convicted driver in our office wanting an occupational license even before the conviction abstract has reached us from the court. And I'm not sure that 30 days is really a sufficient period of time to impress upon people that this is a pretty serious offense. Now, one other suggestion we would like to make, and that is that in several places in the bill, you have used 5 years as the period of time to be counted as to whether you consider it a Class A infraction or a traffic crime or what have you. And in our section here that deals with the mandatory suspension, that period of time is 10 years. And again, we would like to suggest that the committee might consider making that 5 years, so that a person, if he had had a conviction for DUIL, say this year,
and he went 6 years and then received another one. He would still, it would be treated as his first DUIL. If he went only 4 or 5 years, however, it would be the second DUIL. Let me go on to point out one of the very real reasons that this is, we're recommending this. You'll recall that in the last session, 482.477 and 482.478 were enacted, which sets up some very good, we believe, rehabilitative programs with the mental health division involved, and it's so that on the second and third offense, the only way you can get an occupational license or a partial reinstatement of your driver's license in anything less than the 1 year or 3 years in the law is to get involved in those mental health rehabilitation programs and to show some progress. And we get a recommendation from mental health saying this person is sufficiently progressing in the rehabilitation program that we should give him consideration of his license. We've been told that this is a very solid way to get people in the program, that in order to get that license or the partial reinstatement, they'll stay with rehabilitation when sometimes they won't otherwise. But we've also been told that the 10-year provision means that there are some people who are going, the 10-year count period, that there are some people who are going to mental health trying to get classified as a problem drinker or an alcoholic when they really are not in that category. One instance that comes to mind is we've talked about the 58-year-old man from his daughter's wedding, but let's take the 18-year-old kid who celebrates a little bit too much after high school graduation, or he's in trouble, or the 21-year-old, and that's the only thing he has on his record for 10 years, but right at the end of the 10 years, maybe he gets a promotion and he goes out and he indulges too much again. He then has his second DUIL within 10 years. He is not an alcoholic, and he has absolutely no relief as far as any kind of an occupational provision on this particular thing. So we would like to see that count period drop down to 5 years.
What's the feeling of the committee on dropping the period in Section 144 to A and B from 10 years to MC from 10 years to 5 years?
Discussion
and motion. We could couple that with a 90-day increase on the 290 and 3A. That would be suspension on the first conviction in 90 days.
Well,
reinstated.
Let's take the 5 year period.
I agree.
Kurt Paul Roll and then Brown.
Aye.
Carson.
Aye.
Roberts?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Madam Chairman? Aye. Now, you wanted a 90-day mandatory suspension on eluding or dangerous driving, right? And on DUIL, unless the committee decides to give the court complete discretion as to the suspending.
Then it should be, we think, 90 days if it's going to remain a mandatory suspension. And I must admit, we have some real hesitancy about leaving the first DUIL suspension entirely a court discretionary thing.
Why?
Well,
some court.
Yeah, I consider there would be some, I'm sure, that would never recommend a suspension for the first DUIL. They would just or order a first DUIL. Our experience with driving while suspended, when it went from a mandatory suspension to a non-mandatory, strictly discretionary with the judge, has not indicated that it's used too much. Now, I still think, however, that leaving it in the hands of the judge on the first DUIL is certainly in keeping with what we have attempted to do throughout Senate Bill 1 in decriminalizing the first or the class, the first offense of DUIL. I do think that when it gets to be the second or third offense within 5 years, then it ought to be mandatory. It ought to come from the Motor Vehicles Agency.
and it ought to go through only the provisions as far as mental health is concerned. But I think we have decriminalized the Class A first offense to the point that perhaps we should really look at simply going all the way and saying that on the first DUIL, it's going to be strictly up to the judge. This will impose some additional clerical work on the judge or on his staff, because there's quite a few of those first DUILs that they've understood. But I think it is time the committee very seriously consider this as one more step in this area.
What do you
Madam Chairman, not that I particularly disagree with either what Anita is suggesting or a reason for it. I think just so there's no misunderstanding as to the position that the interim committee took on this, the reason I want to mention this is in the last couple of weeks I've talked to two or three judges who were under the impression that the bill, because it gave the court the authority to order suspension under Section 141, that we had taken away the mandatory suspension from the Motor Vehicle Division, or that if we hadn't, it was just inadvertent that we overlooked it. Well, we did not, and you'll see as you look through here that we've included, for example, under Section 144, we've added a new sub 4 to require the court to take possession of the license and permit. To make it consistent with what we said elsewhere about the authority of the court when the suspension starts to run. The big difference, I think, between the authority of the court to order suspension in Section 141, sub 2, paragraph B, you'll see that the court, irrespective of whether it's a first or subsequent conviction, if it's a Class A infraction or a traffic crime, of course, this would include a first offender DUIL, could order the defendant's license suspended for not more than 1 year. So the discretionary authority of the court's order suspension is far greater than the mandatory suspension granted to motor vehicles under Section 144. And that's also why the committee felt we should provide the provision that we did under Section 142, that the suspensions run concurrently. In other words, say it's a DUIL and you had a 30-day suspension, the court made it 6 months. In other words, for the first 30 days, you'd run concurrently, and then you'd have the other 5 months that the defendant would be suspended by the judge. The judge has ordered that.
And what's the, up to what amount is the fine for the first DUI?
Well, up to $1,000.
Up to $1,000. I'm curious to know, Don and Benita's attitude toward how the court would use those two penalties, up to $1,000 and up to a year's suspension, isn't that what you said?
Yeah.
How do you think they would use that in a discretionary way, in terms of money and taking the driver's license? What kind of people would they impose fines on and take the driver's license away?
Well, that's just difficult question to even speculate on, Senator Roberts. If I were just giving a sort of a left field sort of guess, my guess would be is that the judges who now are routinely asking for relief for a defendant who's convicted of DUIL, that is, they request an occupational license, for example, or a permit for a defendant. The ones who just really don't particularly agree with the idea of suspending a driver because of the impact it has on his livelihood and that sort of thing, and the feeling that that type of penalty far exceeds the gravity of the offense. Those judges probably, particularly with the first offender under the new code, would impose a fine much in the area they have now and probably would not order suspension, would be my guess. I think the ones who take a harder line, I think that the fine would be more likely, the greater fine would be more likely to be imposed before a greater suspension would. But there's a lot of variables there. And I think the intent was here was to give the court a lot of discretion to fit the penalty to the offense and the offender, and that we didn't anticipate nor expect that every DUIL defendant would, on conviction, would get a a year suspension and $1,000 bond. That's meant to be the upper limit, and the court would be expected, I think, that Taylor would handle it somewhere under that for
Well, Mr. Chairman, the reason I ask is that it would be logical to expect, I think, judges to find a businessman who says, I have to have my car to go back and forth to work, and to suspend an 18-year-old driver's license, saying that this kid can't pay $500 fine, so we'll suspend a driver's license, and he doesn't need to swirl around his car anyway. And it seems to me that if you're going to, that it should be just the opposite, if you're really going to penalize the person. But the kid ought to be able, ought to be required to pay the $500 fine, get out and work for it, and pay it. And the businessman ought to have to ride the bus to work to have that kind of sense that there is some kind of punishment. That's why I kind of wondered if, you know, judges just go fall into that trap. Well, they can pay, so they'll pay.
You need it looking up the statistics, and you know, not find out.
Probably not, Madam Chairman. Sometimes there's no bus.
Horses and
birds. Well, I heard a guy galloping the settlement.
Judges, too.
Well, Madam Chairman, I hope I haven't muddied the waters. If the committee wants a mandatory first DUIL suspension, we're certainly quite willing to do it. And I think, however, that we would suggest that the first DUIL mandatory be 90 days instead of 30 days. We would still retain the provisions in the law that for work purposes, you had to have an occupational license. That section of the law would be unchanged. But we have really found that the 30-day period that we went to in 73 is a real pain as far as communication and with the court and with the person. I talk on both sides of my mouth. I think there is some real merit to having a mandatory simply as a clear way to say to the driving public, this is a serious offense and this is what's going to happen if you do it. Much more so than if we left it entirely a discretionary matter with the court, which could then be various times or periods of suspension, this sort of thing.
What happens to our notice that we so carefully took care of by having the judge pick up the license? Would it still do the same thing?
There's a provision in here, I believe.
He would pick it up.
He picks it up, and that is considered notice as far as he is concerned. And we would date from, you know, we have, as Mr. Paulette indicates in the commentary, we've got some procedural things that are going to have to be worked out very carefully between the court and the Motor Vehicles Agency in this whole area on the DUILs and these offenses. I think really our key suggestion today would be if there is going to remain a mandatory DMV imposed suspension, it should be 90 days. And our suggestion that the time count be changed from 10 years to 5 years. Now, it would also perhaps be necessary to do a little bit of housekeeping amendment 482477 and 482478.
Yes. Do you have an amendment to it now?
Yes, I do.
When you give it to John,
Those are the only points I'd like to
say. Madam Chairman, in section 141 2B, where it says the judge may suspend, would it be appropriate to, in carrying this logic out, to amend that to read the order of the driver's license suspended for more than 3 months, but not more than 1 year, indicating that that top 9 months would be discretionary with the judge. Of course, the first 3 months would be mandatory insofar as this.
I thought about this when we were talking, and this is maybe putting a minimum and a maximum on that. I don't know.
If the suspension, if the first 3 months suspension is automatic, then the area of discretion would be above 3 months, but not more than 1 year. if you follow what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do.
If you say the judge may suspend it for not more than 1 year, he may not suspend it at all, in conflict with the administrative mandatory, I would think.
We'll have John take note of that if the committee doesn't make the call for the decision to have mandatory. Any other points?
No.
Thank you. Judge Summers?
There's a couple of brief comments I'd like to address the committee about the bill. After working with...
Would you say to me...
Oh, excuse me. I'm Ron Summers, the municipal judge of Adele. Prior to 6 years, 7 years in that capacity, I was the juvenile referee handling traffic matters there from 1963 on. And while I went to law school, I had 3 years working for the state police at night in communications. I did not work out on the road, but road was infrequent. One of the basic things I'd like to point out to the committee after reading proposed Senate Bill 1 is that the proposed amendment, which I understand the testimony has addressed itself to up to this point, and the bill addresses it to up to this point, is not going to solve the problem. Creating something less than a crime on the first offense of DUIL doesn't assist the courts and it doesn't assist the drivers. This legislative body several years ago recognized principally that alcohol-related offenses was not a crime. The legislature has also addressed itself to the fact that we have to divorce the alcoholic driver or the alcohol-related problem driver from his motor vehicle. And the bill isn't going to help that one bit. Draconian measures will not stop the problem drinker from entering his automobile. The fact that he can get one free ride isn't going to stop the problem drinker, because immediately when the citation is issued, and after carefully watching these people for lo these many years, you ring down the curtain and you put the offender on one side and the system on the other, and there is no hope for working himself out of this hole. Soon they realize, from the horror stories their other friends tell them, that their insurance premiums will be increased a minimum of $1,500 over the next 5 years. On up to $3,000 over the next 5 year period. So even if you take away the criminal penalties, the civil fine is still there by the class distinction that's put on these people. On the other end of the spectrum, they're facing two more minor problems and they can wind up without a driver's license for 10 years. So they want to fight. Immediately, they're given no alternative remedy to work their system out and their problem out. Now, 2 years ago, realizing there was some problem, which, by the way, this bill takes our option away to do, in the city, we realized that there was no economic recovery from conducting DUIL trials. The city of Portland, I think they've probably been down, or Multnomah County District Court's probably been down. I told you there, I think something like 1,900 cases pending at DUIL at the present time, waiting for trial. The last time I checked, that's the way the situation was. And all of them are people pitted against the system. We couldn't face it. You know, people started fighting the penalties. You'd see the same people back 6 months later, you'd see the same people back 4 months later. And the only solution to the problem we came up with is, let's develop an alternative system. So now, when somebody comes in charged with driving while under the influence, they have an option, and they're told before they enter a plea to the charge that they'll have 2 days before they can come back and appear and make up their mind what they want to do. They can elect to participate in the alcoholic offender program, which is sponsored by the state of Oregon through a mental health division, for a period of 6 months, and they're required to take interviews. If they complete that program, they can work themselves out of this hole. And they will not have a driving under the influence conviction on their record. It's reduced to reckless driving, and of course now that penalty is going to be changed. So possibly it's the change to careless driving, and the fine would be $285.
No, there's no negotiation with the citation for DUI.
I understand that. You foreclose any possibility of it by either the court or the district attorney. Now, frankly, the district attorney in the county wants to start the program, but he feels he doesn't have the authority to under the present statute. But without developing some kind of an alternate system, a treatment system, where they can work themselves out of the hole, what happens is they just hop right up on the roof and they opt for the program. People who up till that time wouldn't recognize they had a problem, and I could parade some of them down here, supposedly respectable housewives, supposedly respectable business people, they had a social drinking problem. You might not call them an alcoholic, but they had an alcohol problem. And most people who get nabbed have an alcohol problem. They're not alcoholics, but occasionally they go out on a spree and they drink more than they can handle. They haven't learned how to regulate it, or the pressures that go with it. And in almost every instance, I haven't had one where they haven't opted for the program. Now, if they're instructed and they have the instruction sheet that goes with them, if they fall off the program, an immediate plea of not guilty is entered for them, the matter is set for trial. But if you require such a program after they've gone through the catharsis of the trial, you're still pitted against the system, and you're dragging and screaming and kicking into it. And they're opposed to it to start with. And no treatment program can be effective unless the person wants to become a part of it. That's what I'm concerned about. One of the big concerns with the bill is that it's going to foreclose out the program. Most of the people that come in are on their second time around. Not going to eliminate the trial.
A pre-trial diversion?
Yes. You know, a number of states have started them, and Oregon really has never done that in criminal justice. It's far more effective. Far more effective if it's properly run and properly administered. And it's the system of the Department of Health now to decentralize the alcohol-related programs, and you find most of your community hospitals are now establishing treatment centers in the hospital. So it takes away the stigma that I went to Rolla Hills and I graduated, and I've taken a number of people down there. But there's still a fraternity of the people who can afford the $1,700 to go, and there's still a stigma attached to it. And yet there's none if you go down to St. Vincent's and participate in their program, or physicians and surgeons and participate in their program.
Well, Don, the only thing that prevents a pretrial diversion is the negotiated plea, isn't it?
On your proposed statute, yes.
I would think so, yes. But they can still divert, just question what they're going to divert to, as far as a plea to some other offense. Reckless driving would not be there, and with the prohibition against plea bargaining, even with that removed, you still have the prohibition against the plea negotiation on DUIL. There'd still be, I suppose, a practical problem of what other offense would be there for them to plead to.
Tie it to a diversionary program. But I'm telling you, in the small communities, and it goes on in the larger communities too, and in Burns and Wasco County, Intrusion lives, it has, where the heat's put on the guy is at the police department level, not on the DA. You know, you get the guy that's picked up Friday night, now let's get rid of the ticket before Monday morning and it hits his office. And with the system that we have up there, the heat's off the police department. They don't care if they pick up the mayor, the manager of the bank, or whoever it is, because they know they can go in and get help if they want to, and they don't have the stigma. But they all go to the calaboose to start with at point A, which is quite a shock.
You have such a turnover, you never get a chance to know them long enough to put the heat on.
This system is going to increase those pressures on the district attorney. It's going to increase the pressure on the judges. And it's going to increase the pressure on the police department.
Any questions of Judge Thomas? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think he's right. What is the clause of the hospital or the court?
No, help me. Is there any other business coming to
the house? There's a pending case in Montgomery County. I'll be finished.
The meeting is adjourned.